Yesterday, I was talking to some students about the immutable factor of luck in becoming a writer. Luck of encountering a really good mentor. It was a high school teacher. Her name then was Joanna Mason. And
God bless those high school teachers.
I like to think that if you scratch the surface of most poets, you would find that person. Maybe not a high school student.
Right. I have one in my own life.
See, that's what I mean. Exactly. Yeah. We all have them, right?
Who made me a poetry lover for life.
Yeah, exactly. That one person, right?
Yeah.
And that was the one person. She was also the editor of the high school literary magazine. And so I had written some dry lyrics and got them published in the high school literary magazine because she really liked me and I was a precocious kid. One of the poems was a poem about Martin Luther King, who had just been assassinated. And it was a really, just awful poem, right? But
can you remember any of the lines from it?
Sure. And if this world is so great, why am I second rate? Why? That was the end of the poem. I can't remember everything else from it, but that was the gist of the poem. And it changed the perception in the sense of the way the people looked at me and the way I looked at the world. Once the magazine was published and out in the world, the high school that I attended was a very large high school, and suddenly I was a poet. But I didn't know what that meant, right? I was a very precocious kid. I loved going to libraries. Libraries were just these incredible houses for me. Like I said, I grew up in a house that didn't have books. We didn't have books. We barely had a radio.
What did your parents do?
My mother was a housewife, and my father worked first in construction and then at the city water department, for all of his adult life. But the library was this serene, welcoming place that let you wander around. It was clean. It was quiet. There was no chaos about it, and had these little rooms where you could discover things. You could find things, right? And I'm the sort of kid that loved to go and look at the Encyclopedia Britannica, start reading about nuclear energy, and start reading about flying squirrels, and start reading about these other things. And I really loved that kind of curiosity. But it wasn't about the arts. It wasn't about writing until the poem got published. And then people started calling me a poet. And my high school teacher was the person that sort of encouraged that. Soon afterwards, she moved off to live off the land in Nova Scotia, where she still lives. And I would send her packets of quote unquote poems, drafts. And she was the person who took it seriously, who read it and gave me feedback. That's what I was doing when I was a little kid, And that's the person that sort of put me on that path. And so instead of going up to the technical stuff, I started going downstairs to the literary, right? Started reading, discovering poetry books. What's poetry, right? What I thought, the brief encounter I had with poetry when I was a teenager was things like, there was the same soup du jour as everyone got when you're a kid in high school.
Walt Whitman, Emily Dickinson,
right? Robert Frost, right? Langston Hughes as the one black poet. And that was fine, but what did it have to do with me? So I started discovering in the library, what it had to do with me. I was starting to find poets like the Beats, for example, and I think there was a really great book buyer who I've always wanted to meet in the 60s. Whoever that book buyer was in the 60s was buying poetry books. They're probably buying the books because no one was paying attention to them, to him buying them. But he'd buy the New Directions books, and he'd buy the City Lights books, and he'd buy all these other kind of obscure small press books.
Which had the avant-garde poetry.
And suddenly it was like, oh my God, this is what poetry might be like, right?
Well, you mentioned music, and I'm wondering who were your musical influences because you still write lyrics.
Yes. Like I said, the funny thing about this is it's an unguided journey, right? There wasn't anybody saying you should read this or not read this, or you should listen to this and not that. And I hate to say it, it may sound like some sort of, that old trope. We were so poor, but we were so poor. We didn't have a record player. So the library was also my jukebox, right? Play it. So because of that, I had a really sort of you know, bizarre kind of taste in music, right?
So it ranged from
anything, anything. I mean, you could be listening to Bach, to Johnny Cash, to, you know, Van Dyke Parks. The first time I heard The Doors was at the library. First time I heard Jimi Hendrix was at the library. And it was really cool because you know, you're listening to it by yourself. Right? It isn't like a shared, it isn't like you're in a room with a lot of people. You're sitting there in a room with a turntable and headphones
and
on
headphones,
your head.
Right.
And headphones on your head. And whatever that experience is now between you and that music.
Well, you are a walking advertisement, PSA announcement for public libraries.
Yes.
You know that, right?
Oh, yeah. I know exactly what I'm saying. I mean, I adore libraries. I think it's a good reminder of what's good about us.
I want to talk to you a little bit about Cave Canem, which is the workshop publishing house that you created with Toy Derricotte, another poet, for showcasing the work of our great African-American poets. What has been the contribution in your view of Cave Canem?
The thing about Cave Canem, to me, it's still about the fellow who, up until that point, felt that he or she was by themselves, that what they were thinking was just their thoughts, and they maybe might be a little crazy about it. And it's about that moment where they can walk into that room and write the poem they couldn't write anyplace else. I mean, that to me is still the essence of what Cave Canem really is. And it emboldens that person then to go back out into the world. Once they get those tools, they go back in the world, know how to do it. Also, they go back out into that world and understand that they're not the only one out there.
And you really introduced a number of poets who went on to win major prizes and to do great work.
Oh, that's the gravy. That's the gravy. We weren't planning that. That wasn't something that we were out to do when we started Cave Canem. And I celebrate that. So many writers out there are now out there, you know, blazing. Tracy K. Smith, Terrence Hayes, Natasha Trethewey.
Who won the Pulitzer Prize.
Who won the Pulitzer. Greg Pardlow, who won the Pulitzer. You know, it's shifted the idea of what we think African-American poetic actually is. It isn't just the clenched fist in the paint. Though it encompasses that, but it also encompasses so many other layers of experience. I think maybe one way of thinking about this is that it liberates the idea of what we think African American poetry is about and can be about, and it pushes.
What is it about?
It can be about anything you want. I teach African American poetry, and undergrad level, and I would tell my students, or tell workshops sometimes, anything that an African-American writes is African-American poetry. If you wanted to be experimental and African-American, that's African-American poetry, right? If you want to be a traditionalist, then that is African-American poetry, right? You know, you get to define what that means in the parameters and the definition of your own life and your own art. No one else gets to name that. You get to claim that. You get to own that.
What would you advise a young, aspiring poet who might be listening to you today? What advice would you give him or her?
Well, I'm going to tell you one thing about all poets. You're going to do it regardless. You're going to do it by. You're going to do it. You're going to find a way of doing it. And there will be obstacles. There'll be things that get in the way. There'll be things that will deter you. There'll be things that'll make you doubt. There'll be times you think, you know, why you're wasting your life on this stuff, but in the end, you know, it's the only way. It's the only answer that makes sense for you in this life. Now, maybe what you're thinking about is will I be successful as a poet, right? You know, or will my poetry get noticed, or where will it get the acclaim that actually you know, I wanted to do it? And we're all ambitious. But so much of poetry has nothing to do with this. And I'd like to tell that young poet, you know, you can do it. You have to stick at it. Persistence is really the trick. Usually when I start a workshop, I tell them the three things you can't teach in a workshop. You can't teach experience, you can't teach ambition, and you can't teach luck. That's up to the poet, how they're going to apply that. And luck, to me, my definition of luck is the door opens. But you have to be prepared for that. You have to keep at your craft. You have to be, you have to keep at it. And I would also say, find allies. Find people, that aren't trying to tear you down, that aren't trying to discourage you. Being a poet is a really important thing. It really is. I really think, especially given the moment we're all passing through politically, I think it is one of the most necessary things. The life and the imagination is really, really crucial. And then you see proof of that by noticing how much energy is being expended to try to shut it down.
Would you be so kind as to read one of your poems?
Sure. Okay. I'll read this one. The poem's called I'm a Fool to Love You, and it's a poem that came about when I asked my mother how did she and my father meet. This is the story she told me. I'm a fool to love you. Some folks will tell you the blues is a woman. Some type of supernatural creature. My mother would tell you, if she could, about her life with my father, a strange and sometimes cruel gentleman. She would tell you about the choices a young black woman faces. Is falling in with some man a deal with the devil in blue terms, the tongue we use when we don't want nuance to get in the way, when we need to talk straight. My mother chooses my father after choosing a man who was, as we sing it, of no account. This man made my father look good. That's how bad it was. He made my father seem like an island in the middle of a stormy sea. He made my father look like a rock. And is the blues the moment you realize you exist in a stacked deck? You look at a mirror at your young face, the face my sister carries, and you know it's the only leverage you've got. Does this create a hurt that whispers, how you gonna do? Is the blues the moment you shrug your shoulders and agree? A girl without money is nothing. Thus, to be pushed about by any old breeze. Compared to this, my father seems, briefly, to be a fire escape. This is the way the blues works its sorry wonders. Makes trouble look like a feather bed. Makes the wrong man's kisses a healing.
We've been talking with Cornelius Eady, the award-winning poet. Thank you so much for sharing your insights.
Thanks for inviting me.
I'm Judy Valente.